Welcome to the Military Millionaire Podcast, where we teach service members, veterans, and their families how to build wealth through personal finance, entrepreneurship, and real estate investing. I'm your host, David Perret, and together with my co-host, Alex Felice, we're here to be your no BS guides along the most important mission you'll ever embark on, your finances.
Vehicle 1, you're clear to depart friendly lines.
Roger, Vic 1, Oscar Mike. What's up, everybody, and welcome to a unique episode of the Military Millionaire Podcast. I'm here with my good friend, Marcus Long, and we are standing in the middle of the old Union Station in St. Louis at the Real Estate Wealth Builders Conference, RubeCon, hosted by my friend, his friend, Dustin Heiner. And I just realized Marcus has never had a full episode on the show. He's one of our longest standing members in the war room, in the military millionaire community. He's crushing it in multifamily. He's a coach now with seven-figure flipping multifamily. And I was like, why have we not done the show? So we're just going to do it right here, and we're going to see how this goes. So, Marcus, thanks for joining me.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Yeah, man. So I guess you want to give a little background to everybody. I know, you know, retired from the Navy a year ago?
Yeah, just about a little over a year and a half ago.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, so, yeah, my kind of background, as you and stuff. So I was in the Navy right out of high school 22-ish, 3 years ago. And yeah. Later on, got my commission and went back to the University of Missouri. So go Tigers.
There you go.
And just transitioned out, retired about a year and a half ago. And, you know, through my kind of the background there, I have so married, have two kids, a 9 and 6 year old and stuff as well. And that kind of drove some of my decisions, timing of like when I decided, you know, I wanted to transition out of the military and kind of started my real estate journey. Going back to whenever I got my commission, I bought my first property when I was 22, when I went to college at Mizzou and house hacked that before I knew what house hacking was. Just kind of luck of the draw and the circumstances, and I kept that as a rental. That's one of the few like single family properties that I actually still own today. But that kind of started my real estate journey. Started acquiring some single families throughout my career, and as I got kind of towards the end, you know, a lot of what I had done was opportunistic, and kind of decided if I didn't want a W-2 full time job after the military, I was going to use real estate as that kind of means of what I was doing. But I needed to be more systematic about it. So that's kind of when I transitioned into the larger multifamily a couple of years before retirement. And yeah. Now here we are.
Yeah, I didn't realize that you bought your first property 20 years ago. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of times we always say like, oh, I wish I would have started earlier. And when I look at it, I did start early. Yeah. When I was 22. I wasn't necessarily intentional or focused very early, right? Like that, I lived in that property for a few years. When I moved out of that property and rented it, it was another 3 years or so before I bought my first one. It was deploying and things like that. So I wasn't really thinking about acquiring more that consistently. Yeah. And just kind of over time, continued to accumulate them. And by the time I transitioned into multifamily, I had about 15 single family doors. But
oh, wow.
Really, so not a bad small portfolio, but it really started to take off when I joined, when the war room started. I was one of the first 10, 15 members when it started. And just kind of starting to be around other people. And that's really when I started getting exposed to different strategies as well. I didn't know a lot about other strategies outside of long-term rentals and stuff. Yeah. I'd done a little bit of Airbnb, like in my own house and things, but really when I started getting educated on other strategies and people that were successfully executing those strategies, and I started investing passively in different ways. And then eventually as a general partner and stuff as well. But yeah, the good part is by starting so early, acquiring that first property, like, even though I wasn't super intentional quick, you know, I ended up having, by the time I became intentional, I had equity in some of those like early properties where I could use to, you know, acquire new ones. So
that's awesome. So yeah. So you, I mean, kind of, I wouldn't say accidentally bought the first house, but you bought the first house, it sounds like, much more from a like homeowner, I want a place to stay mentality than like, I mean, 20 years ago, yeah. This stuff wasn't really all over the world for you.
Yeah. 100%. Like I was a finance major and stuff. And so I was always kind of like financially minded. I think I'd probably read a couple of books and I knew that like real estate was a like wealth building tool, but I bought that property more from a perspective of like thinking about like the debt pay down and building wealth like over time. Yeah. I didn't analyze it. It was a new construction condo and stuff. I didn't analyze it as a rental property or anything. Like, you know, I thought like I got a condo because I was an hour away from family and I was going to go home on the weekends a lot to work on the farm. I didn't want to have to mess with a yard and all that kind of stuff. Right. And so it's in an HOA and that kind of stuff. So there were I was thinking of it for the benefits of myself while I was living there, not really analyzing from a rental property and by house hacking it while I lived there. And then even when I moved out, it's always cash flowed a little bit. It's not like a home run, long-term rental or anything, but because of the equity that I gained in it, reused that equity multiple times. And I actually still own that today. That's one of the reasons I've actually kept that property.
You guys see me eye darting. I'm ADHD as all get out, and I can't handle the fact that the same lady just walked past us three times just to confirm that we're podcasting. So I'm like, anyway.
Maybe we should give her the link to listen to it later.
I know, so. Right? I'm like, she like just walked like right behind the phone and like giggling about like, oh, I think they're doing a podcast. Like, did it take you walking around three times to figure that out? Anyway. Good for her stretching her legs. You know, we're in the Midwest. People don't do that. So there you go. She's getting her steps in. Okay. So what was the catalyst that got you into multifamily? There's a lot of people like nowadays, it seems like the journey, it's like, oh, I'm going to wholesale, then I'm going to flip, then I'm going to hold some. And then I'm going to like, next thing I know, I'm buying an apartment complex. But you know, that wasn't the case 4 years ago. It was like multifamily was still scary for everybody.
Yeah. So I think that when I joined the war room, that's around the time, just shortly after I had moved to England, which was my last duty station, right? And so I moved over there in July of 2019. I think that fall, October 19, was it? Or October 20, I forget. But anyway.
September, October of 2019.
So shortly after moving over there is when the war room started. And in 2020, I really started investing passively quite a bit myself. I had some conversations with different people, and I'd sold a house in Colorado. I had some cash. I thought at the time we were going to be doing quite a bit of European travel. That was before COVID happened and crushed our travel dreams there. But so I decided like, hey, I was 4,000 miles away and we're going to travel a bunch. So I was like, I'll do a little bit more passively for this like phase in my life. And so I just started doing some private lending. I invested passively in a few syndications, primarily with other members that I had met and connected with in the war room.
Yeah.
And so I started getting the flavor for myself of like the passive investing. And then when COVID happened, I had a lot of time at home. I was looking at it and like, hey, my retirement is about 2 years out and I need to be more, as I mentioned earlier, a little bit more like strategic in that transition and what I was going to do post-military. And I started like looking at some of the different strategies that I had invested in myself and what I enjoyed and stuff. And at this point in time, both being a passive investor, as well as like people in my squad and stuff like that were investing in multifamily, I started to get more educated about it. And I really enjoyed the aspect of like what passive investing had done for me when I was overseas. And so I started thinking about like my friends and my peers that were still active duty, right? That were stationed in Japan and Italy and Spain and all these other places, Germany, and the impact that I could have for them by providing those opportunities and stuff. And so I liked multifamily just from a, on the single family, we had self-managed a lot of stuff. Some of it was in like small rural towns in Missouri and things like that. There wasn't like a lot of property manager options. And so I looking at the teams, there's certainly us as general partners are very active and asset managers, but just the scalability and the business plans that we put together and the partners we had and good property managers, I liked the multifamily business and then the opportunity to be able to bring that investment opportunity for a lot of my peers who might want exposure to real estate in their portfolio, but didn't necessarily have the time or desire to be active themselves. Yeah,
there's really not, I don't want to say there's not a better passive strategy for real estate, but it's definitely one of, if not the best. For somebody who has a high income or has cash sitting around, but doesn't want to learn the entire game of real estate, there's nothing that makes more sense to me than jumping into a syndication because you can do the note investing. That's super passive if you do the right thing, but you got to keep the money moving depending on how long the note lasts and you don't get the tax advantages.
Right.
Whereas the syndication side, you can hold this for 5 years. Depending on how it's structured, you might get your capital back at 2 years and then just interest, or you might get your capital back at the end, but you're going to get that generally 15 to 18% IRR projection, which is great, but you get the cost seg up front and you can take a tax hit. So if you're making $200K a year, you can slash your tax burden by 30, 40 grand off one investment, which I love.
Yeah, I think it's a super powerful investment tool. And I think because of the different, whether it's cash flow, the growth, the tax benefits, like there aren't very many investments that offer the range of benefits of a syndication like that. And certainly it's one of the most passive means of investment and stuff. Once you made the investment, I think the passive investors the real work is the due diligence and stuff on the partners and and understanding them and enough education on the strategy to ask good questions, right? But there's not hardly a more passive way. And if it aligns with their goals, right? I think that's one thing I really enjoy also is talking with investors and what are their family and financial goals. Mm. And that can mean a lot of different things. But even if you take a military person, for example, sometimes I've had them say like, hey, I have a couple hundred thousand. I'd really like to invest this, but I want to use it for a house when I move in 2 years or whatever that might be. Well, syndication might not be the right fit there, right? Because your money's going to be locked up longer. So having those conversations and understanding what are their financial goals, their family goals, what are their intentions, what are they looking to get out of the investment, and then kind of helping them align business plans or strategies with what is best for them. And maybe my syndication isn't the best answer for them, but maybe I can help connect them with someone they can just private lending for a couple of years or something like that. But in many cases, just through those conversations, I can educate them on different options that they may not have known were available. And I really enjoy doing that.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. The hotel we just took down, which I know we've spoken about, if you invested $100,000, the projection is that you would get $44,000 back as a loss from the cost seg or whatever. So it's a $44,000 off on your taxes against your income. But the way we're doing that one, it's like a 10-year hold, but the projection is that 3 years we'll be done with we'll have finished the renovation. We're doing a $3 million renovation. And then we'll have finished that and we'll have had a year of stabilized NOI and we'll refi it. And as long as the projections hold true, we would be able to give you 100% of your capital back. And then from there, it's a 50-50 split on income for the next, 7 years. And so it's like, you're not always locked into the long-term 5 or 10 year hold. It just really depends on the strategy for that specific property. Have you read the Hands-Off Investor?
I have.
I love that book.
I recommend that book a lot of times, both to some of my potential investors and stuff, as well as even some, as you mentioned earlier, I coach in a 7-figure multifamily. So talk with a lot of other coach people that are trying to be general partners and stuff as well. And I encourage a lot of them to read it also for a couple of different reasons. Number one, it helps them understand like questions and concerns that their potential investors might have and that they'll be asking. As well as what it does, I think, pretty well. Sometimes when we learn different strategies as a general partner or something, we learn like one way of doing something, depending on who our coach, our mentor is, and how they do it. And the Hands-Off Investor, in some cases, explains two or three different ways that a general partner might do it. And not that they're necessarily right or wrong, but they're different ways of doing it and understanding why they might do something one way or another. And so I think for a general partner, it's a good book for them to understand like, oh, this is how my coach taught me that there's this other way that can also be done and understand that as well.
Yeah, I think it's a great, same thing. I hand it to people or at least recommend it to people who are interested in becoming a passive investor because, I mean, there's really not a whole lot of books written from the LP side.
Right.
And that book does a really great job of saying like, without overcomplicating the underwriting, like, here's a red flag. If you see this, dig in and can help you avoid those mistakes. I mean, things happen. It's an investment. At the end of the day, you got to be accredited for a reason, right? So sometimes you lose. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see a lot of people figure that out over the next year or two. It's kind of already happening with some of these people who took on bridge. One of the things that I've told people for a long time is like, if you're looking at a deal and they have the same exit cap rate or better than the entry, I would ask questions. And if their projections are based on market increases in rent rather than forced value, okay, I would have questions. And unfortunately, I think a lot of syndicators took on debt 2-3 years ago that short bridge loan, value add, the market will help us out, blah, 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 blah. And they're in a tight spot right now. Anyone on interest only or bridge that's coming due. I have a friend who just went down in Phoenix, took 2 or 3 apartment complexes down. But if you're playing a more long-term or conservative game, I think it's still such a great investment opportunity. You just got to know what to look out for.
And that's, I kind of in the process of like educating my investors and understanding, like talking about like the Hands-Off Investor, like I kind of try to share some things with them to kind of keep an eye on it as they're looking at opportunities, right? You kind of mentioned some of it, and like the things like lining up the debt with the business plan and stuff. Like we tend to try to get that kind of matches up the term of what our business plan is and stuff. And like in some cases, it won't always be that way, but that's a good opportunity for them to ask the question of the general partner, like, okay, you have a 5-year hold or a 7-year hold, but your term is 3 or 4 years, and make the general partner or sponsor kind of like be able to describe why they are comfortable with that situation and confident. You know, I mean, if they're acquiring something at a very low basis, maybe it was inherited or something, and like the children just want to get rid of it. It's being sold very cheaply. Like there might already be a lot of equity there that you're pretty comfortable that it's going to be ready to refinance in 2 to 3 years or something, versus expecting market rents to be able to help you refinance it.
We couldn't find a bank to lend on this deal, and this is the only loan we got. Well, all right, I'm going to have fun raising from someone else. I'm out.
We had an opportunity last year. There was a property that we were under contract on for a lengthy period of time that we ended up backing out of that contract. And ultimately, there were a lot of different scenarios and situations or like that went into our decision to do that. We had an opportunity to close it with some debt that we didn't initially intend to, but that's not what we had presented to the investors. Mm-hmm. You know, it was some bridge debt, and like we would not have been cash flowing for the first year and a half when what we originally had presented was a different debt product.
Yeah.
So we chose not to close that, right? And moved on to the next opportunity.
What did that cost you guys on the syndication side? Did you have an out still in due diligence? Or because I know I've not yet seen this bite anyone, but something I hear starting a syndication for each deal can be pretty cost. I mean, between environmental studies and due diligence and inspections and appraisals and, you know, cost seg studies and everything. I mean, it's not uncommon to be six figures into one of these deals before you close. And if you walk after the due diligence period, which I've seen, like that's something that I've not seen it bite anyone yet, but it's always worried me. Like, what if you get to the spot of like, the GP is like, I don't want to lose my 100K. Let's just push.
Right. Yeah. I think that we certainly lost money doing so. Like, as far as like how much, that can change a lot based on everyone's individual contract, right? And like, from a GP perspective, like we really try to give ourselves outs along the way, or the way it's written, like when the due diligence period begins and things like that. Because if they have to provide certain amount of documents or something, well, technically the due diligence doesn't start until all that stuff's been provided.
Yeah.
So we try to give ourselves that kind of that room to work with on
Man,
that.
That's smart, because I've had sellers, they're like, oh yeah, we're working on our tax returns and our T-12s. And you're like, how do you not have a profit and loss? And it's been 3 weeks, work harder.
Right. Yeah, so and that's what my partners and some of my coaches and stuff, you talked about ways to put things into contract, to kind of give yourself the best opportunity and the most times like get out if you need to, whether it's physical or digital due diligence or other things. And so, but regardless, even if you get all of your EMD back, there is still a lot of like time and money involved, like the SEC attorneys, or there's money, or if we had contractors and stuff that went out to do inspection things. So the time we spent, travel, all that, right? And so there's still a lot of money lost by leaving the contract. And I think while in that circumstance, I don't think any of us looked forward to going back to our investors and saying, hey, we've decided not to close on this property. That's not a fun conversation that we wanted to have. But ultimately, I think we gained a lot of respect and trust, because it was a cool property. It was a cool business plan, and a little bit more exciting, if you will, than some of your just like standard boring ones. But ultimately, sometimes the boring ones are the good ones. And so I think people had like this excitement about being involved in this particular business plan and property. But when we told them why we had made the decision and stuff, I think during this time period, we couldn't lock the interest rate in. It was kind of climbing and the occupancy dropped. There were just a lot of different scenarios there that we decided wasn't the best option for us. And so I think they really respected the decision not to execute the contract and get into something that we were locked in for a few years if it wasn't the best scenario. And we had another opportunity coming up right after that. And almost a very, very high percentage of those investors reinvested in that next opportunity.
Yeah, I was going to say, you definitely earn the respect. Anytime you walk away from a deal because you don't think it meets a standard, it's a whole different ballgame than going into it. Like, because there are definitely people who are like, oh man, well, we don't want to piss off our investors or whatever. And they push, and it's like,
There's going to be a lot more opportunities to piss them off.
Yeah, man. Like, I don't know that there's a better way to gain an investor's trust than to say any form of like, this isn't good right now, whether it's like the deal changed or the deal sucks, or we missed this, or we found this, or what you said earlier, hey man, you want your money back in 3 years. We can't guarantee that. So maybe you should look at this instead. I think almost any time in my life that I've pushed someone away, been like, nope, not for you at this time, it has come back tenfold. Whether they come back and they bring people to the group, or they bring more capital, or just that relationship capital. I mean, shoot, I joke about this all the time. Maybe not all the time. Probably not enough. It's probably been, some of you probably never heard it before. But my buddy Mike lent me 90K second position on a property, and it was the worst flip I've ever done. It was supposed to be 6 months. It took 15. It was supposed to be we ended up going $70,000 over the rehab budget. I mean, it was a whole mess. And Mike was, he got 2 points at 10% interest. And once we hit 12 or 6 months, he then got a third point and it went up to 12% interest. And so Mike ended up making like $16,000 on the private loan, and he got paid every monthly installment, every payment, every dollar. And I lost almost 30 grand on the house.
Right.
And from like a credibility standpoint, I'm like, anytime anybody's going to lend me money, I'm like, you can talk to this guy. I mean, I've got plenty of investors that won on deals where I won,
yeah.
But the one deal where I got smashed and he stuck with me through all of it and he made money. It's like, well, there's my guy.
Similar story I've shared a couple times, but one of the last like single family properties that I bought before I moved into multifamily, I was living in the UK and intended to kind of do a burr and stuff. And it ended up being a major fiasco, and I had some hard money on it. And then I had some private money lenders, other members of the war room actually were mostly my private
lenders.
There
you go.
And so they loaned me money, started executing the rehab and everything. I paid them off within the year or whatever. And it was like, as I mentioned, a fiasco. The rehab went on, there was permitting stuff long after the investors been paid back. And some of them didn't even know, like, the property was still vacant. I hadn't been able to like refi or rent it out until I was telling the story later on. And they knew like, oh, I loaned on that, right? But they'd gotten their money back and didn't know any different, right? Because I ended up paying them out of my pocket when the note came due. And it was like 2 years later when they realized that was the situation. I mean, they knew it was taking longer, but they didn't realize like a year or 2 years after I'd paid them that I was still not getting income from the property, right? So, but I think that speaks a lot for, you know, just like taking care of them and
that's it,
one way or the other.
Yeah, if you take care of your investors, they come back, they bring friends. They're like, look, dude, it's not a guarantee, but homie will pay you out of his own pocket if something goes wrong. And I've got a few friends. I mean, honestly, quite a few people I know in the war room in general that I will literally feel comfortable telling people like, look, man, if this goes south, that guy will pay you out of his own pocket to make it right. I've said that about a few people. And it's funny because you mentioned raising money from the war room. And I mentioned, this last deal, probably $975,000 that I raised came from the war room of the like 1.25. And I tell everybody when I talk about the war room, and this is by no means a pitch, but I'm like, look, the war room, it's not a place to do deals. It's not a place to pitch deals. It's not a place to expect that you're going to throw money at someone and get a return. But holy shit, dude, over the last 4 years, it's incredible to look back and see how many, I mean, I need to go and just like do the math. I mean, I would imagine the war room has bought $500 million worth of assets together, not including everything else. And that we've probably had close to 50 million raised through the group. I mean, because I know you've got invest, I've got like all these different guys that are doing $1 million raises, and they're almost all people in their group. Shoot, one of the squads in the group bought a freaking $7 million golf course together because I'm like, oh my gosh.
It's interesting because like when that first property, that single family one that I bought before, I was just talking about before I moved into multifamily, that was just a few months after the war room started. And it wasn't like I went to the war room and said like, hey guys, look at this. It so happened. Like I was in the war room. We'd been talking about like starting a thought leadership platform and stuff. So I had kind of started my website, started creating my email list and things. And it just so happened that some of the other members of the war room got on my email list. And so when I had that property, I sent out an opportunity for private lending, and that it was who ended up kind of investing.
That's exactly how it works. We just talk through problems and what we're working on. And the number of times I've heard someone be like, yeah, well, one of my sticking points right now is I need an extra $50,000 for this project. And then somebody else in the group is like, let's talk after the call. I've got $50,000 that I need to. And the same thing, like that 975 or whatever that I raised from people in the war room, half of them I didn't even know were on my email list for the investing side. And I've never pitched a deal in the group itself. It's cool. You know, it's just,
I just try to like share education in whether it's that format or others and stuff, try to provide value and let people know what I'm doing. And if it works with their strategy, they're interested in the education, that kind of stuff, they'll come, they'll set up a call, they'll have a chat with me and things like that. And then when the time comes, when we're doing syndications or private lending or whatever, for those that it works with. But it's been a powerful group. And as I mentioned, like early on in the call, like that network, and whether it's the worm or you have another network and stuff, it's just so powerful to so powerful to be able to whether have people with different options, like even for myself, like there are people in the world that all kinds of different investment strategies and stuff. And so at different points in time, like I use my self-directed IRA to do a lot of private lending, and I don't do it like use as much private lending myself anymore.
Yeah.
But like I private lend sometimes to other people who earn, sometimes to others and stuff. And now when I first started private lending, I got a lot less interest than I do now, because over time, my network and the number of people that I know that use private lending, my knowledge and sophistication of it have increased, and I'm able to get a higher percentage of points, whatever that might be. And so if you don't have a lot of options and you're relying on one person, you may not be able to get as much. But when you put yourself in a position where, you know, a lot of people around you, you have a lot of opportunities and options.
Yeah, the network, the brand, the community, all those things are, I would say, one of the most powerful levers in real estate, because it's like, I understand the asset. Now I have the ability to raise the money, and I can do, you know, three times the deals with the same effort, capital, whatever, because I've leveraged, whether it's other people or the resources or just the fact that you have a track record and people, you know, follow along. Because all your investors are going to tell their friends if their friend mentions like, oh man, I wish I could do whatever. So now we just need to figure out how to get LP investors to show off their checks at closing like wholesalers do and just say like, yeah, gross profit. Like you give them a check with all their principal back plus like 10 grand and they're like, look at this $110,000 Marcus gave me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. A lot of LP investors don't get quite as excited about showing that off on social media and stuff. But I have been in my own business and stuff like that, working on asking a few of my investors and stuff to do kind of like some referrals or testimonials and stuff recently. And sometimes that's just setting up like a 15-minute call and asking a few questions and asking them to answer that, and then using some clips from that. And one of the things in multifamily is it takes a little bit longer to kind of get a good referral testimonial that I would want one of my investors to give, because
you're 10 deals in getting your first referrals. Right. You're like,
you know, early on, like I think that investor could speak to the customer service that I provide up front, like the education that I'm providing, or like the investment process, helping them through the portal and things like that. But because the investment is a lengthy one, right? Like I don't feel comfortable asking them for kind of a referral or testimony until they get far enough into the deal, at least to see like that it's performing, they're getting their distributions or whatever. Even if it's not like we've sold the property, they've got the complete returns, but they can speak to like the monthly communication that they get, the distributions that are coming and stuff like that. So it takes a little bit, it's longer game than sometimes if you're doing like flipping or private lending or something where you can maybe get some of that testimonial referral a lot quicker.
Yeah. Okay. So you get into multifamily. You've done quite a few deals now, mostly from my understanding in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah. Primarily in Tulsa. I have a couple of things in Texas and a couple in Tennessee, but Tulsa's kind of the core.
Yeah. Which is a good market. Yeah. Actually, it's fairly similar to Springfield. It's a bigger metro for sure, but similar vibes. Okay. So what is your main, are you mainly the capital guy? What is your role generally in your deals? What do you handle?
Yeah. So like largely on those, like I tend to always sign on the loan. So we often, there's 3, 4, 5 partners.
Yeah.
We generally all sign on the loan together, both to use like our collective net worth and liquidity for it, but also to kind of split the risk amongst the partners.
I just signed the debt on that 130. So
yeah. So we kind of have some like buy-in and stuff on it. I tend to provide EMD, whether that's kind of similar, like sometimes we might split that amongst the partners to kind of diversify the risk there a little bit. On other occasions, depending on, we kind of have a conversation. If someone's more liquid at the time, one or two people might take that instead of the others. I certainly help raise a pretty big portion of the capital.
Say, you've been pretty consistent about that.
When we kind of talk about these roles, I have some partners that are, you know, very good with the acquisitions, relationships with brokers and some sellers in the market. Also very good with like asset management, the project management aspect, and knowing that they, like I hop on a lot of the asset management calls so that I know what's going on at the property. I can relay that to investors and stuff, but I'm not solely responsible for that. So knowing that they are responsible and execute very well day to day with that allows me to focus on investors, both the education piece a lot and as well as in his relations after the ones that have invested already. Because I'm actually only about 3.5 hour drive from Tulsa. So I go down there pretty frequently as well. Certainly like if we're doing, when we're doing physical due diligence and stuff, but, probably every once a quarter, if not more, physically in the market and stuff. Smart. Where we spend, one of the partners is there every month, and stuff. So sometimes I'm there more frequently, but we'll go and spend a couple of days and go to all of our properties with the, spend a few hours at each property with the property managers, just kind of walking around to put eyes on the things that we talk about during the asset management calls. So,
I love that. I was involved. You see how to word this, because I'm technically still involved. The first deal I ever raised for, and we won't give any specifics here, it hasn't gone tits up. It's not been terrible, but it has definitely not been great. But I've got some frustrating things that I'll talk about more when it comes out. But like, essentially they asked the GPs to do a new raise, and they were like, if you don't raise, you're going to lose 90% of your allocation. And I'm like, I don't feel confident raising for this right now, because I don't feel like throwing money at bad is the answer. I feel like we could do it. Essentially, for about 9 months, we'd been having issues with this property. And every time they came up, I was like, hey, when's the last time somebody from the GP went to the property? And after 9 months, they answered me and they were like, oh, last week. When's the last time before that? Crickets again. And I'm like, dude, like, you didn't go to the property for over a year when we knew there were issues, and all the issues are management issues. And we can't get the asset manager on our call with the GPs. And I'm like, the GPs are, this is a pretty stacked team of people who helped. And I'm like, dude, this whole mess. And so, unfortunately, a lot of times, people who raise capital or manage these deals may never see the property at all, let alone yearly or quarterly. So I love that. I think that's great.
When we spend, I think from the very beginning, when we started, I was still in the UK. My first probably 400 units multifamily, I was still over there, as were some of my partners. And it was a little bit harder early on because it was kind of in the beginning of COVID and stuff like that. But we also knew that if we were investing from that distance and stuff, that investors would have concerns or ask the question about like our presence in the market. And so we were very intentional early on to ensure that we made, you know, frequent trips. And so one of my partners who had left her W-2 and had the ability to do so would at times go and spend 2 or 3 weeks in Tulsa at a time. And sometimes there were properties that were not struggling, but like have slower getting started than we wanted. And she was there helping do unit turns and things like that. So like physically at the property, helping to make sure things were going as desired. And then now we're all back CONUS now. And like I said, someone's at the properties on a monthly basis, pretty much.
Yeah. And I love that. I think any business, right? Anywhere you go, anything you do, you inspect what you expect. If you're not checking in, the manager might be the best manager of the world, but if they get comfortable, they're going to miss things, or they might just not care about things the same way you do. And so like anytime I go by the hotel I own, that's, it's like 45 minutes from where I live. So I'm always got a reason not to drive an hour and a half just to go see the hotel for an hour. But anytime I go up there, I'm like, hey, we need to do this. We need to do that. What about this? Can we make this tweak? Oh, hey, I really like the whatever. And so I'm like, yeah, I need to make it up there every month at least to look at the property, because it's just little things that, and I would say there's too much. Like if I go buy all my residential properties, I'll probably might as well manage them myself, because my property manager is going to be like, what are you doing? That doesn't matter. So there's a balance there, and I want to be as passive or as hands off as I can. So I only really mess with like the bigger ones. But it's such a great idea to actually physically look at your properties, because you'll always catch something.
Yeah. And I think kind of going back to your initial question about like the roles and stuff, like when you're getting into this stuff, it's one of the reasons I like multifamily and stuff a lot too, is because it is a team sport, right? And there's these different roles, whether it's the acquisitions or the underwriting, asset management, capital raising, and each of us have unique skills or interests and stuff. And so I might really enjoy educating and spending time with investors, and I'm a finance major, so I don't mind the spreadsheets and stuff either, but someone that enjoys those conversations might hate spreadsheets and not want to be in the underwriting and stuff.
Show me a picture of it now, a picture in 5 years, and how much money I'm going to make if I give you money.
And someone that like might really love the conversations with brokers or something might not be into project management and the asset management. I like that you can find a couple roles that like fit your interests and skill sets, and then when you're looking for partners and stuff, find ones that have complementary skill sets. Just because you and I are best friends, if we have like the same skills or interests, we might not make great partners because we're still leaving some other gaps. And so I think that's a pretty powerful thing. And it allows me, and as I mentioned, like while I spend a lot of time with investors, raising capital, like my name's on the loan, I'm doing EMD, like I'm involved in these other ways. I go to the property pretty frequently. But because I really, really trust my partners that are doing that asset management, it allows me to really focus and deliver value in the area that I'm doing, right? And same thing for them. Like when they know that I'm going to deliver value in that area, they can focus on their responsibilities and their roles and be better at that instead of all of us having our hands in each other's pie.
Yeah, I think that's great. And that is something it's funny because for the longest time, I was like, I'm not going to start my own team because I don't want to deal with all the SEC shit and all the crap. And all. So I'm usually on the investor relations side or the marketing side. Like with the hotels, it's a lot easier for that because it's like, I'll do the Airbnb, VRBO listings, the Google business page, the reviews, the system for getting reviews, like the smart system where you ask if they want to leave a review 1 to 5 stars, and then the system only sends you to Google to leave a review if you click on 5, those kinds of things. Because God knows what happens with bad Google reviews. I'll build that kind of stuff out and do investor relations, but I don't want anything to do with the operations, and really neither do my investors, because I've got a million things going on. I'm not detail-oriented. I'm like, I'm great to come in and be like, these are the 7 things we should do to increase revenue, decrease expenses from like a high level. But the moment you put me in charge of actually making those 7 things happen, we're not going to make any money. Whoops, I'm sorry. Yeah. I tried. Like the idea was there.
The visionary and the integrator.
Yeah, absolutely me. Right? Yeah. So, yeah. Almost every one of my business failures can be linked back to having the wrong person managing the thing because it's not supposed to be me. And if I have to take over it, that's a problem. And so like that house I talked about earlier that I lost money on, my acquisitions guy was also my project manager, and he quit to do it better himself 2 weeks into that property. And I got stuck with this massive, had a fire in the kitchen house that I'm like, I don't want to be managing this shit. And so it's just a big issue. But also, he could not do it better himself. I think he got one wholesale deal and then threw in the towel. And the last time I heard from them, his wife had to take her first job ever, and they had to put their kids in public school, and it was the worst thing ever. So, I'm not going to name names because I actually paid him 10 grand to sign a release saying he'd never use my name in public again. Whole weird thing. But yeah, suffice it to say, don't burn every bridge in town. Bad move. So anyway, it's a weird situation.
Right.
I don't think I've ever actually talked about that side of things on like publicly, but that was, you met him once. He came to Seven Figure, to one of the Flip Hacking Live. Anyway. Weird.
I won't guess names either.
Yeah. It's all good. You're right. So we talked roles. We talked why you made the transition, why you like multifamily. What advice would you give? Like, who do you think, let's do this. Who do you think it's right for on the LP side versus the GP side? Like, when should somebody look into this style of investing?
Yeah. So I think some of this kind of goes back to, we were talking earlier about like educating investors and like figuring out what strategies are right for them to invest in. And so understanding someone's like family and financial goals.
I was about to go help this guy because I just saw like 6 people walk by him and he couldn't figure out
open the door for his kids.
But he's got it now. So
like understanding the family goals and stuff like that, right? And so that's one of the, like, just across real estate and stuff in general. And that's one of the beauties is like there are a lot of different strategies, some of them that are very active, some that are very passive. And like, even like with the benefits of whether it's cash flow, whether it's growth, whether it's tax stuff, there's a lot of the different options. And so trying to align those strategies with what your goals are and stuff. And so I think that's true. And so like within multifamily, I think most people probably could benefit from, well, multifamily or syndication of some nature, some asset class and stuff in some way, whether it be with their personal funds or with maybe like retirement funds or something, like having some exposure to it. So on the passive side, certainly, whether it is someone, as I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of active duty or military peers and stuff. So maybe someone that's like, you know, deployed, or maybe just maybe they're some other W-2 that they really enjoy, but super busy and don't have the time to dig in. So they read a book like The Hands-Off Investor. They spend some time with us to get educated enough to like understand what they're investing in, but they don't have to worry about stuff day to day, right? So people that are, you know, busy professionals, maybe someone that had maybe they did active for a long time. I have some people that are kind of like retirement age that used to have a small portfolio of rentals or something, and they're kind of tired of doing that, but they like real estate. And so they kind of sell off some of the portfolio and invest in passively this way. So they kind of hand that off. So those are, I think, some examples of like who are good potential passive investors, maybe even like real estate agents or real estate professionals who have a lot of active real estate income. It'd be great for the depreciation to kind of offset some of that active income. And then like on the GP side, you know, I mean, you have to, you know, they're pretty like big projects and stuff, and it's a team, as we talked about earlier, kind of a team thing. So there's a lot of ways that you can provide value, whether it's multifamily or a different asset class on a syndication or these things, whether that is from like You like communication with brokers, communication with investors. You like underwriting or analysis of markets or project management, asset management, working with the property managers to execute and stuff. And so I think that with all the different strategies in real estate and stuff, we kind of have to align those with our goals as well as like what we enjoy. Like I don't have any desire whatsoever to do any wholesaling or even like flipping, like those things like don't align with my personality and stuff. And so we have to, and you gotta be able to like work with a team and stuff in here. But I think those are some kind of examples for like passive and active side.
Yeah, I love it. I would say my favorite or the people that I've seen invest the most in my deals have been high income earning W-2 Amazon employees or Facebook employees, or actually most of my recent raise was Amazon and Facebook employees or their spouses, or somebody who had a large windfall, doesn't know what to do with it. One of them was someone who they took a windfall from selling a duplex and they put it in a self-directed IRA because they were like, I'm going to do all these things with it. And then they didn't. And they were like, hey, you can, that was actually a fun conversation because they were like, you helped us buy our first duplex and now you, now we're going to invest it with the, you never know what's going to happen with stuff like that.
Talking about the IRA, I kind of mentioned earlier, I said most people could probably benefit, like maybe not with their personal funds right now, right? Like maybe if someone has like a shorter term need or something like that, as I mentioned earlier, like the syndication might not be right. But anyone that has like an IRA or something like a retirement account could probably benefit with some exposure to real estate using their retirement plans. And like, I have a few, again, I won't name names and stuff like that. Some of them are close to me and stuff, but like people that are pretty high income earners that invest a lot, like in their companies, retirement plans and stuff. And that's not necessarily always a bad thing. Some of them are good retirement plans, but I, in my personal opinion, I think there would be good to diversify some of that. You know, I mean, you look into like Enron and stuff out there, not that every company is going to be like that, but that's an example that people know where if you have all of your kind of cookies in one jar and stuff, that people could benefit from diversifying their retirement portfolio and stuff as well.
Yeah, I definitely, like I have my TSP. I love it. I love having a fund invested in index funds, and I have an IRA and VTSAX, Vanguard's total stock market. I have TSP, but I also plan to do the self-directed side of things with part of that so that I can also have part of my retirement fund be real estate. Now, I haven't done that yet, mainly because over the last few years, all of those assets have done pretty well.
Right.
And I'm still active enough investing that I'm like, I'll just keep rolling my own capital into things.
Although that might be a better time to pull them out and put them in your self-directed than waiting for them to, waiting for a time when they're not doing well.
I agree. So. In fact, what I was about to say is, you know who would be the best syndication investor if they're not a total idiot? And I'm going to just call you a total dumbass if you watch this cycle a third time. Everyone who's got a shitload of money in Bitcoin right now, when you think it's kind of peaked, maybe you should put some of that money into something with a hard asset behind it before it plummets again and you wait for the next freaking halving. Because, my God, the number of people I know who were like, I made $1 million, I bought a Lambo and I lost it all.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, even if it's going to do this thing, which is fine, like I'm not opposed to crypto. I have a percentage of my portfolio in crypto. It's an asymmetric bet. I get it. But like, when you look at your account and you're like, I've got $1.5 million in here. Holy shit. Well, imagine if you took a third of that and stuffed it in something that's not going to drop that much in value, that's a hard asset. And then you have the tax advantages to negate some of the gains and all that other stuff. And then you've still got $1 million in crypto. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's, a couple that's of my, on the IRA piece, not the Bitcoin, but like the couple of my recent investors that have just invested, they invested with a self-directed IRA because their IRA had done so well in the past year. They kind of like captured some of those gains, put it in their self-directed and put that into the real estate.
I love it. Yeah, I think that's great. What did we miss? What else do we, I know we don't, within that, we're at 47 minutes, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's we covered quite a bit of ground and stuff. Yeah. And certainly, I guess just kind of talking to like going back on my journey and stuff like that, the, and some of the reasons like I chose multifamily and stuff and vice a W-2 and all that, just the options that it has given me. And I'm probably just as busy now as I was before. And I think that's a lot of the case with a lot of entrepreneurs, right? We leave a 40-hour week job to go work 80-hour, whatever it is. But the beauty of it is just like, you know, I am able to schedule a lot of things when I desire to, so that I can be present for my kids. They were a big driving reason why I left the military when I did. And just the options it gives me, like I'm traveling 3 out of 4 weeks in the month of March, and I don't like to be away from home a lot anymore when I'm by myself without them. But like we went on spring break together, I'll see them this weekend and stuff. And so having that option to like take them on some trips, once in a while they'll go to a conference with me and stuff, and or they'll come watch me speak, just be able to spend that time. And so that was a lot of the driving reasons why. And I try to stay true to that when I schedule my calendar and stuff and be there for them. And if other people are kind of having that, how can real estate impact them? Or it's not like an overnight type of thing, but if you're thinking like, how can it help me have more options 5 years from now or 7 or 10 or whatever that is, I think through this stuff for myself. I'm love to like have that conversation and help other people think about it and stuff as well.
Yeah, I think that's so Blake Daly, who I just closed on this hotel with, and then Deanna Oso, who is a friend, Josh and Deanna. I was on a Zoom call talking to Blake's group the other day, and Josh and it's so funny. That door doesn't say push or pull on either side. And so people walk up, they try the wrong way, and then they come all the way around. Hilarious. I did it yesterday. So they were both talking about, Deanna just put in her 2 weeks notice. Blake is out of the military on the 21st. Yeah. And they're both like, oh yeah, I'm looking forward to having all this free time. And I'm like, I'll talk to you guys in 6 months and see how much free time you have. Cause we just fill our plate with whatever, which is great. But even then, like to that point, I'm just as busy, if not busier now. I travel more. I'm not in a routine as often. Like I'm all over the place than when I was in the military. But was it 2 weeks ago, I woke up. I didn't feel great. I walked around the house. I did my morning routine. And I was like, nah, I still feel like crap. And I went and texted my sister, was like, cancel everything. And I went to sleep till noon. And I was like, there's no consequence. Yeah. I have the ability to just like shut down for a day and go play dad, or I think that stuff's huge.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, like I said, I have in my calendar every morning, there's the time with my kids. You know, I usually help them get ready for school, make their lunch, all that kind of stuff. And like, I'll do calls before that. I'll do calls and stuff after they're gone to school. Yeah. Lovely kids in the background here. But like, I block off that time with them, and then like, I don't have any calls scheduled by the time they get home from school, right? Yeah. Like when they come home and they say, hey, daddy, let's go play in the backyard. Like if they want to go play with the neighbors or something, I'll continue to do some work. But if they come and ask me, I want to be able to drop what I'm doing.
Absolutely.
And go do that. So if I can be a resource for other people that are trying to go on that journey and look for options, I'd love to do so.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's huge. Where can people get a hold of you if they'd like to invest or just talk to Marcus?
Yeah, so I mean, probably the best is like alonglegacy.com. That's alonglegacy.com. On that connect page there, there's a calendar. I mean, it's open to anyone. You can schedule a time on there to set up a call, Zoom call, phone call. My email is marcus@alonglegacy.com. All my social media and everything's on there.
Oh, I'm going to pause for effect because we've got someone. So there's like I don't know if it's a cheer conference or what that's at this hotel this weekend, but there are more like high school girls screaming and running than I've seen in a long time. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like I feel for the poor chaperones. I mean, it is spring break, so I'm sure there's some kind of something going on, but alonglegacy.com. Marcus is absolutely a go giver. He's always given time to talk to people and help, and definitely connect with them. And, man, thanks for hanging out, taking an hour out of your day at the conference to talk story.
Appreciate it. It only took 3 years to get an invite, but it's all good. We're here now.
I got nothing other than I'm chaos incarnate. You got to come. I'd say you have to come to me if you want to be on my show, but I don't want 100 of you to come to me. So,
I got a relationship with me.
Don't pitch shit. Then come to me. We'll talk.
I got the unique in-person
St. Louis Union Station opportunity.
So.
Maybe 3 or 4 episodes ever done in person, but you're only the second person since I bought another one of these. So, and the first one was with Dean, and we were drinking and playing the cash flow board game. So, and that kind of turned into a podcast. Good times, but thanks for joining.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.